I love the concept of cathedral thinking that is becoming more more sort of talked about, where we have this capacity to build incredible projects, you know, literally those cathedrals that were built over a number of centuries, where there was a vision of what was wanted. It was also something very much rooted in the community and the local area where it was being built. But, you know, it was something that then generation after generation took on and added to in their way. So they all shared a vision, even though the vision sort of became adapted over time as materials changed, as circumstances changed, as the next generation brought new ideas to it. We have a capacity for this. The question is whether we, again, our systems are setting ourselves up for this.
Hi there, it's Steve Ingham here, and a very warm welcome to the Supporting Champions podcast. Now, this podcast is all about exploring the dynamics of high performance with people who have been there and done it, people who have supported others to succeed, or have explored performance concepts in real depth. And we hope that you can find something in these conversations and insights that can help you reflect and develop yourself or the people around you. And we hope that they can support and champion you to understand, relate, and progress in your work, and maybe the way that you live your life. Now, I'm delighted to share with you the news that we're partnering with a multi-award-winning health food and drinks company, Junius. So Junius have made a superb range of plant-based juices. They're all cold-pressed, so the nutrients aren't blitzed in the process of making them. And what I really like about Junius is Maria, the founder, has put some genuine thought into the unique formulations, some with more of a focus on protein, some with more of a focus on energy, and others blended with a caffeine shot for when you might need a healthier way for a pick-me-up. I also love the fact that they've got some really groovy names such as Fab, Zip and Rev. So I would wholly recommend giving these award-winning juices a go. And we've teamed up with Junius so that you can benefit from a 10% discount on your first order. They have a range of themed boxes with 7 juices plus 7 juice shots that you can choose based on your health goal, or you can choose a mixed selection box to give them all a go. In the show notes of this episode, you'll find an exclusive code CHAMPIONS10. And when you go to the checkout at wearejunius.com/shop, make sure you enter your code. So we are delighted to partner with Junius. Give their juices a go. They are absolutely genuine quality nutrition. And so to this week's guest, Dr. Kath Bishop, who competed as a rower at 3 Olympic Games, Atlanta, Sydney and Athens. And I had the privilege of working with her throughout her career. Now, Kath won the World Championships in 2003 and an Olympic silver medal in 2004. Since retiring, she was a diplomat specializing in conflict issues, and Kath was posted in Sarajevo, Bosnia, Basra, and Iraq, as well as leading in Whitehall on the UK civilian contribution to conflicts around the world. She now speaks and is a consultant with a range of different organizations, including a number of business schools. And uniquely, Kath has written a quite profound book called The Long Win. It's out on the 13th of October. And this book calls on us all to redefine what winning is. Kath brings extraordinary insights together, backed up with numerous anecdotes, references, and her own experience to examine what winning has come to mean to society and to us as individuals, and offers what I would say is a really fresh and contemporary perspective on how we might redefine success, personal and professional, for the longer term. All right, well, welcome to the podcast, Kath Bishop. How are you? You're right.
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, really good, really good. I'm excited for this conversation. A bit wary that we could speak for hours on this, because we often get on one, don't we? So right, The Long Win, in brackets, available to pre-order and at all good bookshops. There you go. There's a plug, depending on when people listen. Let's get into that. I'm really keen to unpack that. I've read through the book. But can I ask your permission to be a little bit almost mischievous today in our discussion and challenge some of the propositions that you've put forward in The Long Win? And I think the reason I want to ask your permission for that is that, one, I encouraged you to write the book because I I kept hearing your voice and your cause, and I thought the world needs to hear about it. Part of that is I provided a testimonial for the book. I'm also still finding my way with some of the concepts that you've developed. And finally, the last reason I'd like to test some of your concepts is that when you were a rower, you used to really grill me. It was always, why? Tell me more. What do I need to do? And it was just, it was very testing. So is that okay? Would that be all right?
So it's a sort of revenge conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I'm really happy to be tested, because actually for me, that's the purpose of the book, both for me and more widely, is that it's provoking a conversation, a debate about issues that I think we don't spend enough time really understanding at a deeper level. So it will help me to further my thinking. And that, again, was a reason for writing the book, to help me think through what are the challenges, what does this mean in practice? So totally up for that.
Fantastic. So before we get into that, the book, available at all good bookshops, can I just reflect a little bit on your rowing career? So I met you in 98 in probably in the bull rushes of Longridge down near Marlow. And so for me, as much as I think you're awesome as a person, my first impressions of you were, I hate to sound too cold about this, 6.5 litre lungs, 5 litre VO2 max, 250 watts before lactate rears its ugly head, ventilating 200 litres per minute. You were a phenomenal athlete. When did you know that you had that talent?
Oh, it's such an interesting question, because I came into sport very late in life, and you know, it wasn't till university that I picked up an oar, and I had been firmly deemed as a sporting failure at school. I mean, I wasn't just average, I was positively, you know, bottom. And so it took an enormous amount of time for me to shift my identity, to accept that these figures that you were, you know, so bluntly putting before me meant something extraordinary. And I think, you know, throughout my sporting career, it was still a challenge to accept myself as being an athlete that could compete at the highest level, you know, having literally been sort of bottom of the class and told not to bother really at school. So, you know, having the evidence was certainly part of helping to sort of, you know, adjust to this new opportunity that was, you know, just so exciting to then explore. And I think, you know, the upside of not having been a child sporting prodigy, of course, meant that it was a real adventure with people like yourself and others to sort of just explore what's possible here, because there was nothing that was prescribed about where I was going to get to.
And now, so we were hiding in the bulrushes on one of the banks, diving into the water. It was 1998, and you'd come back out of the Atlanta Games, and you were in the middle of, so we were surrounded by Gwyn Batten, Miriam Batten, Gillian Lindsay, Sarah Winkless, Alison Mowbray, and you were in the middle of a coaching program with Mike Spracklin, which was relentlessly hard, super hard at the time. It was almost like the first wave of professional training for women's rowing.
It was.
How was that to cope with?
Yeah, it was a lot to cope with. And thank God I had that physiology. Otherwise, I think I probably would have gone under, to be honest. The physiology saved me. It was a very high intensity program, as you know. There was, you know, sort of sessions that didn't create lots of lactic acid. You know, that was seen as something for wimps. It was all about high volume and, you know, high intensity. And so, you know, we all know now that kind of puts a lot of people close to the burnout threshold and quite a few over it. So it was real environment of last woman standing, as it were, but also, you know, an incredible group of athletes who were hungry and desperate to show that the women rowers could perform at a level that had never been seen. So rowing is historically a male-dominated sport and a hugely traditional one, and one we've been very successful in. And it was a real sort of, you know, a burden, really, that the women had yet to win medals at the highest level. And that was something that, you know, we were frequently told. And there was a sense of, you know, are you going to be different or are you going to be like the rest? And yet I knew some of the women before me had been phenomenal athletes, but just not had the opportunity to develop to their potential for a whole host of reasons. I mean, the lottery had only just come in 97. So it was beginning that process of levelling up women's and men's Olympic and Paralympic sports, but really early days still. So again, it felt like we were all on this sort of, you know, pioneering adventure, but also well aware we could just fall flat on our faces, you know, and this big question mark about who are going to be the ones who first win the medals. Is it possible? Are you good enough? Are you tough enough? And that mantra of are you tough enough was really, you know, what governed every single session that we did.
Yeah, and I remember the sort of almost wretched looks, just thinking, God, we are so tired. We need to know that what we're doing has some results at the end of it, that this is going to be worth it. And the results did come, didn't they? I mean, 98, you were second at the World Championships. Gillian and Miriam won in the double scull as well. So results did come.
Yeah, so I mean, again, there was a, you know, a flood of relief, but also joy that there were results at the 97 and the 98 World Championships. There was still a sense of, are these going to last? Are these short term? Was it just a fluke? You know, there was still that real sense. And of course, could it be reproduced at an Olympics? But I think sort of it was our first real exposure to, you know, support on a level that you and your team were giving. And, you know, I was really hungry to understand more. And, you know, whereas a lot of the coaching regime was just around, you know, being tough, how much can you take? I was really grateful to have people like you to grill, to kind of start to understand, you know, really, how can I work with you? How can I tap into what's there? You're telling me the figures are good. How do I relate that into, you know, a performance and, you know, a performance under pressure? So it was also a huge learning curve, I think, for all of us at that time, where it wasn't a norm. We hadn't come into sport with any sense of understanding the science of it. And it was developing within rowing and more broadly. And of course, the questions of intensity were ones that you were grappling with, the coaches were grappling with. And there was a lot of mythology still about what was the right level of intensity, which probably for you as well were kind of really thought-provoking times.
Yeah, you're questioning, you're grilling, that PhD level inquisition. That was high volume, high intensity questioning at the time. So it was a proper workout for me. It genuinely was, of questioning why we're doing what we're doing, but also so many different perspectives and questions about the certainty or the probability that this will lead to success. It was a fascinating, it was a hugely developmental time for me, likewise. And so silver in 98, world indoor rowing champ in 99. So what was your view of what happened from 98 through to 2000?
So just to complete the end of the year results, yeah, Sydney ended for me with a ninth place. So I went to Atlanta and came seventh, won a silver medal at 98 World Champs, but then slipped back to fifth in 99 and then ended up ninth in Sydney. And, you know, at the same time, the physiology was moving on and, you know, in incredible ways. And I suppose, you know, the big question after Sydney was, how could my physiology have moved on so significantly and so, you know, in such a world leading way, and yet the performance hadn't matched it? And that for me was the beginning of realizing the much broader world of performance beyond physiology, or what was required to make that physiology work for me, what was required in terms of the environment, the mindset, the behaviors, the relationships we had as athletes, as coaches, and with all the support staff. All of these areas that were being overlooked whilst we were just trying to be the toughest we could possibly be. So, you know, but it was a huge, I mean, Sydney was a crisis for me. 4 years of, you know, as you described, a fairly brutal regime, even by brutal rowing standards. You know, that leaves you with just, you know, endless questions and, you know, a crisis to try and understand what that meant.
Crisis, that's quite a full term, that is. That's that you've chosen that word specifically there. What was that? Unpack that for me a bit.
So the journey was about winning medals. That's what everyone had told us we were there to do. That's what the big question over all of us was. And the biggest stage to do that on was at the Olympics. You know, I had the physiology, I had the figures there saying I could be the person who would do that, who could do that. And yet I hadn't. And I think the crisis came from, you know, me also associating the failure to perform with being a failure, that connection of identity as a sports person with your performance somehow justifying your existence as a human being. Because that in that environment that had been, you know, so easily the same thing, we weren't allowed to have a life outside of sport. That wouldn't be being dedicated enough. That wouldn't mean you were really trying to be the best you could be. And so inevitably, when the performance isn't there, you know, there's not a lot around you to help you start working out that process. I mean, it took me, I would say, a year to 18 months to really gain perspective on it. But that was probably the most developmental and useful 12 to 18 months when I look back now in retrospect, because it forced me to start to question some of those assumptions about my identity as an athlete, the values that I had, you know, how I could be true to myself in a different way, how I could not purely justify my existence through whether I won a medal or not, you know, how I'd slipped down a slope of believing certain things about, you know, just being tough was what mattered above how I had relationships with other people, above the quality of enjoying what I was doing. Again, it was a very sackcloth and ashes time, you know, environment. And so there was little opportunity to enjoy the journey. And I realized that had been a kind of a big mistake as well. But it was getting feedback from different people, a whole range of people I worked with. I'm sure you were one of many that I questioned about, you know, I had the figures and the physiology, you know, why didn't this work more broadly? And getting a perspective by stepping away from the sport and actually starting a different career gave me enormous sort of opportunity to really absorb the lessons and then come back again as quite a different athlete.
Yeah, I remember a specific conversation. I don't remember where or exactly when it was, but it was you gave me the feedback like, I'm done, I'm finished. Or at the very least, I'm putting a big pause on this to think about whether I'm going again. And my campaign to you was, please go again, urging you to give it another go, that you had the hardware there. And one of the I remember a very specific conversation I had with Paul Thompson, and he'd just moved to the UK, just taken up the women's coaching role. It was in Marlow, one of the little cafes there, cup of tea and a sandwich in a darkened room. And he was grilling me of, right, first of all, he was, right, why is Jürgen's program so successful? That was the first point. And then secondly, right, what have I got? What's in play here? And that conversation had a very large part dedicated to Kath and Catherine, from a physical point of view, that's a resource in terms of if you can get that moving a boat, you've got firepower there. That was the one conversation I have with Tomo about your absolute potential to do something. And then 2003 world champion. 2004 silver. We've had this conversation several times, but that difference of one place, does that almost need reconciling in your mind? Does that need an explanation, or are you content with it?
I think it's part of the reflections that have continued since 2004, you know, that led up to 2004 and that have continued about what winning means, how others see your success. You know, as much as my own response to it, other people have a response to it. You know, more people will ask me about how I felt about coming second than they do about how I felt about winning a world championships. I mean, Greg Searle talks about how people ask him more about how he came fourth at Sydney than they do about the other medals. And that was a real kind of driver for the book. This sort of, we're all trying to work out what it means. We're all trying to understand what the right response is, if you like, and what meaning we should put on these results that seem to be externally validated. It's what's written in the newspaper. It's what's held up. It's what you put on the CV. It's what people announce before you give a talk. So, you know, it's definitely part of that debate that I feel really fascinated by. And I think, you know, the time away before 2003 and four is, you know, it was getting that additional perspective that enabled me to come back and, yes, pursue winning, but with a whole different meaning around it. And that then helped me to put a meaning to what happened in Athens and to, you know, to think about what winning silver means. There's no question that since early life, you have people saying, you know, if you come second, you're a loser. You've heard that, or, you know, from the playground onwards. You hear it sort of certainly within that sporting environment that we're not here to win silver. I mean, the number of times I must have heard that. So it goes in. It's part of the messages you're hearing from authority figures. You know, we've got to be here to win gold. That's what it's about. You know, you hear that. Steve Redgrave comes and talks in unbelievably inspirational way about that's what it's all about. So, you know, of course, you're trying to reconcile all of that with, you know, that 7 minutes of effort and the fact that you crossed the line second.
Let me phrase this in the right way, that you've got the resourcefulness to be able to pause, reflect, reassess, reevaluate what's important for you in the middle of your career, and have done so since in a phenomenally comprehensive way through the book. But I don't expect most athletes have that, of the sense of self-awareness and also the agency to think, what's this all about? Why am I doing this? And I need to reorient myself to a different version of success whilst you're in it. That seems like a real shame for a lot of people, that they're so caught up in it that they haven't necessarily the facility to be able to pause and reflect, take a breath in and think of a different way.
So I think that should be at the heart of a performance environment. And that's, you know, that's one of the drivers of writing the book. I mean, I think most athletes are incredibly resourceful. And, you know, the longer you compete, I think the more you realize that the mental side of it, the cultural side of it has a huge impact on you. I think there's more awareness, you know, more widely of that as well. So, you know, in my mind, that's a really important part of being an athlete. And I think actually the responsibility required to sit on the start line at the Olympics requires you to have that agency and that awareness. So I think most athletes are pretty hungry, and it's a real shame if we're not providing environments where that can be fully explored. It's essential. I mean, I was totally caught up in it for years, and it took me, you know, the crisis of coming ninth, if you like, and then a year out of the sport, and, you know, a lot of, you know, really, yeah, hard thinking, a lot of asking for feedback to work it out. So I think we could do a lot more to support athletes to have these conversations from the start about their identity and their values, about what success is, about what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, along the way. And you know, that's what I hear the public debate crying out for now, if you like, whether it's about, you know, the gymnastics environments or more generally about the sort of medal winning approach that we've had over the last 20 years. I think a lot of athletes are hungry for that.
And have you had any reflections about why? I mean, I think you probably had your career at the back end of a system that wasn't a systematic way of developing people to the top of the podium, it generally the people who were champions had that what we would call almost selfish view of the world of, I'm going to knock people out of the way in order to win. I'm going to do absolutely what it takes. And probably that prevailed at the time because it was so extremes. It was so disproportionate and intense and probably effective because it required an extraordinary person to do that off their own back. And that was almost the template of people that had won through the 90s, that you were vicariously looking across and thinking that's probably the way you need to do it.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. In my mind, it's one way of approaching, trying to be your best. But at that time, it seemed to be the only one, as you said. And it was a sense of, I've actually got to succeed despite the system, or because there isn't a system in the early days. So, I'm trying to create something on my own as an athlete. And then I think there was an interesting transition that the system started to come online, but that mentality was still there. And rather than now thinking, how do I use this system to get the best out of me? There was still sort of quite a lot of this, really quite a negative phrase, I'm fighting against the world, it's me against everyone else, that aggression and hate-fueled motivation that people had to rely on when they were literally fighting on their own. It was hard for that to shift over, and I think that we have been slow to develop an understanding of a different psychology based on other ways that human beings are motivated, and often much more powerful and more sustained ways. By trying to be your best, you don't need to hate your opposition to perform at your best. But again, these sort of mantras and mottos of don't respect the opposition, they're the enemy. All of that is very strong. It's a macho narrative I see also in the workplace, but it doesn't help people to be at their best. And yet people can sort of just feel that it's what they've heard. It's perhaps what they've heard from, retired athletes, from parents, from teachers, from coaches. And it feels like it's a tough, strong way to approach something. But I think we've been too slow to really unpick, the damage that happens if you're stuck in that mindset for a long time, and the self-limiting aspects of it too.
Okay, so we are segueing into the book, The Long Win, and that leads me to ask a specific question. Why do you think this hackneyed, knee-jerk view of winning at all costs, why does that prevail? Why is it so persistent, and why is it so dominant that we're questioning it at the moment?
Yeah, well, I wish I knew the answer. And writing the book is kind of almost asking that question. Why, when we marshal all the evidence, are we still relying on some really outdated, ineffective mantras and beliefs? And I think these beliefs are hard to shift when they're reinforced across society. And, I look at how winning has become so ingrained through history, through just even looking at the history books, which are full of battles, of the victors, of who was the strongest, who is the most dominant, which country had most power and wealth. And these sorts of definitions, if you like, of strength and success that are still the ones that dominate most in the history books. Now, we have come to a point where there is so much other information available, freely available to everyone. A lot of the social movements at the moment are questioning what we're teaching, are questioning how we learn about a wider view of history, about women, about Black lives. So, we've come to that point where people are saying this isn't good enough any longer. But of course, it's history written by the victors for the victors. It's very self-perpetuating. There's a big, if we get into the sort of bigger question of society, we have to look at the establishment and the narratives that are quite self-sustaining there. That's a lot to unpick. Power and wealth is a lot to challenge and overturn. But of course, that's the opportunity. If we can find ourselves to a better way of living in more equality and with, a real sort of different respect for the environment, for each other, for people, if we can shift those values in a way that makes sense, then actually, the The opportunity is endless, and it's an exciting time for that. We see change happening in all sorts of places. You know, the environmental threat is creating a movement like we've never seen before. But, you know, that's also struggling against the established norms, the established narratives of what GDP growth means and how we just get on the wheel to churn out more and more consumption across our societies. So, I mean, you know, I'm just kind of jumping around absolutely massive topics, but winning is an ingrained part of, you know, society that's been reinforced, many of us at school, by our parents, by, you know, our family situations from a very young age. So to challenge that is, you know, is not easy, but challenge it we must, because everything we learn from anthropology, psychology, biology, you know, tells us that we don't need to live that way. It's very constraining and limiting to us.
Okay, so let's get into some of the details then about the concepts that you cover in the book. And I'd like to give it a bit of a shake about. As I say, I'd like to try and explore it with you rather than just nod and agree, because it is a formidable piece of work setting out your treatise of thinking about a different way of winning. So could you? So you've stated the problem there. You've stated the almost the what's the issue that we're dealing with, and what's your proposition? Could you spell that out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to sort of complete, if you like, where we've got to, I think the thing that's been a huge driver for me looking at the sporting world is literally, I don't know, 5 or 6 years of endless stories of athletes with mental health issues, not feeling fulfilled, feeling empty. And even the winners, even those on the top step, are saying that. You know, it's not just our silver medalists, if you like, who, you know, are kind of hanging on to that sense of being one off the top. The people on the top level of the podium, you know, too many stories across sports of people saying they felt empty, they felt unfulfilled. And, you know, that really put a question mark in my mind. This isn't just about my own experience. This is something I'm hearing over and over again. You know, the surveys that EY did about, you know, 40% of athletes having mental health issues after they leave. I mean, the stats are frightening, and that is a massive kind of wake up call, I think, to any of us interested in the potential of, you know, sport and what it can offer to both athletes and society. And so that's really what I wanted to look at. Yeah, how do we do this differently? What are the key elements of that? And the sort of three themes that I talk about are the three C's of clarity, constant learning, and connection. And that first bit is about clarifying what matters, i.e. it doesn't just matter what medal I get. It actually matters how I win that medal, what other people think of me, who I train with, who I compete with. It's that clarity of purpose of why am I doing this, not just for myself, but going beyond myself. So that meaning of crossing the line, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever it is tied to something beyond this fraction of a second you cross the line. You know, we've often led to believe in the sporting world that happiness will come at that point. You know, I was told, you know, don't expect to enjoy yourself until you get to the top of the podium. That's happiness. That's joy. Now, if you buy into that, that means you have a miserable time. And then there's that fraction of a second you cross the line first. Suddenly life changes. Well, it doesn't work like that. But that's the myth that people have bought into, who suddenly find themselves on the top step and realize, I just crossed the line first. Now what? I feel empty. I've got no one to share it with. Because we need to connect crossing the line first, or in any other position, with something beyond yourself. What's come before in your life, what's going to come after. So it's all about developing that clarity of purpose, of meaning, of why are you doing this? For yourself, what's the purpose? But also beyond that, what does sport bring to the communities that you're in, to your family, to your friends, to society? We have an opportunity to create change through sport. I mean, Marcus Rashford is being an absolute hero, role model at the moment, about the impact that sport and athletes can have on, you know, standing up for others. You have a platform for which to also role model values and the way in which you approach performance. So that clarity piece, it's coming back to that conversation we had before, really, about, you know, what's the why you're doing this? And is there space within your environment to question why it's important to win a medal, why it's important to go fast, rather than just the what of what's on the training program today. Here I go, full pelt. So that first piece around clarity is having some of those conversations that we're not used to having in sporting environments, but can unlock, I think, a huge amount of performance as well as a better experience of sport.
So can I pause there then? So I don't think we've covered constant learning and connection as much, but there's a few concepts in there that are interesting. So a large proportion of athletes having mental health issues, and you know, this is only really just rolling out. This is only something that that people have been willing to start a conversation about. It's been previously unspoken, and again, from a devil's advocate point of view, I'm interested in this idea that there's going to be a cost to the pursuit to try and do something extraordinary. Will require compromise, will require some sacrifices, will require a disproportionate diligence that could wear people down to do something extraordinary. The same sort of reports have come back from people who've been into space, and then they come back down and they've done something incredible, not only the preparation, the actual performance of it, and then they come back down and then it's just, life's not going to ever be much better than this. Is this the price that that athletes have to pay?
So I don't believe it has to be like that. I think we do see it. You're right in, you know, Buzz Aldrin's sort of Magnificent Desolation was how he viewed Earth from space. And then he suffered when he came down and described that same desolation in his own life. I think, again, it's because nobody discusses what comes after. Nobody's talking about what does this mean and how will this relate to your family life and your career hereafter. So, you know, these costs, let's discuss them. Let's check that we're up for them. We're making assumptions about costs, and we're making assumptions that if you turn up at the sports environment, then you've bought into these costs. Well, if we understand what the costs are, we can maybe choose and actually shape what these costs look like. And you know what? We might also think, well, I don't think that's going to be right for my life. And I think that's okay too, rather than end up going down a route that leads you with a sort of ongoing long-term mental health issue. I think a lot of people do walk away currently from the environment who have great potential because they don't see these conversations about the wider purpose and the meaning of the sporting journey, and actually think, this isn't for me, I'm going to go and do something that has more meaning. So I think there are huge benefits, only upsides, from having these conversations. And the slight fear that we would somehow put people off is madness, because that doesn't make sense of the whole logic of, if we're up for anything, then surely we're up for a conversation about the costs that we're about to take on. I think we also don't accept the question of what's an unacceptable cost. So this is a phrase that Chris Chambrett, the sports psych that we had for many years, uses. You know, what's unacceptable success? Now, clearly there are some lines that we don't want to cross. Doping line is the most obvious one. But I think there might be other ones in terms of, you know, abuse and bullying and intimidation. And we don't discuss what the unacceptable cost might be, or an unacceptable definition of success. And then when we cross the line, there's no way of knowing it. And of course, you go way too far before you suddenly realise something's gone very, very wrong, as we are seeing on a horrific scale, particularly in the sport of gymnastics, but it's also present elsewhere. So, you know, these are really vital conversations if we're going to commit fully and be able to believe in what we're doing. So, you know, yes, there are costs, that let's discuss those. Let's be absolutely clear and make sure that we're not assuming there are certain costs that it's OK to be bullied. Well, I don't think it is. And I think a sporting environment should be saying as well, this is not OK. These are questions for everyone in that sporting environment, not just the coach. It's for not just the athlete. It's the coaches. It's the support staff, the performance director. Everybody involved should be discussing. You know, I think some of the kind of coaches suffer terribly as well, and this expectation they have to be present at every single session. Otherwise, they're not committed, or something might not happen. And it's hard for them to bring the perspective they need to look at, you know, the minutiae of what's going on. And when there's a really difficult patch, you need to have some time away or time thinking, you know, talking to other people in order to get perspective and a fresh eyes on what you're seeing. So I think, you know, others suffer from this, not just athletes.
So I'm hearing there that there's an element of drift of what is acceptable, and that perhaps when people come into those environments for the first time, part of the acceptance of a newbie is this is the way it is. This is the level, and also that standard or that indoctrination drifts further and further away from perhaps what your younger self would find okay, that you've grown with it, you've adapted to it, or you've just coped, or you've just been quiet about it.
Totally. I mean, how many of us have heard that? You know, are you willing to do what it takes? Have you got what it takes? I mean, we see it in all those Hollywood films, and it's well-meaning. Yeah, we know it's going to be absolutely tough as hell. I'm not saying it isn't going to be unbelievably difficult, but at the same time, we need to have some values underpinning this system of respect, of ensuring that we are caring and looking after people's well-being. Those cannot be sacrificed, in my mind, if we want sustained performance that is acceptable. Nobody's, the medals that have been achieved at a cost of, you know, the health of an individual, that doesn't look so glorious anymore, does it?
So do you think the absoluteness of those standards, they just help make it simpler? So saying this is the standard, this is what it takes, this is the brutality of it almost. Do you think it just makes it simpler for people to deliver it or to manage it or to bring people into that environment rather than it being nuanced or complex or it depends and having the subtleties to the not only the life experience, but also the pursuit? Because just sort of laying down the law would probably make it easier and simpler for people. And having coached at Olympic level, you crave simplicity because you've got so much noise about what decisions should you make every single day within every single session. And you just want to make it really simple for people.
But if simplicity is leading us to, you know, abuse people's well-being, then that's not a good aim, is it? I don't think winning is a simple activity. Don't get me wrong. Winning a gold medal is what we, you know, absolutely the aspiration. And I don't want us to stop wanting to do that. But I want us to be clear about how we go about it and what's acceptable on the route to that. And I don't think simplicity for simplicity's sake is an argument to defend some of the poor behaviour and toxic cultures that we've seen. You know, we need to be ready for the complexity required to win. You know, to be world leading is not going to be simple. And there's no reason why our environments and cultures should be simplistic. It is complex. You know, the science, if you like, the hard science, the physiological science is complex. And so is also the cultural science. And, you know, that should be seen in my mind in the same way. And the well-being science, these are all complex. And you know, if we've got a sophisticated system, then surely we can manage that. Actually, giving athletes and coaches the resources to discuss these issues can only help them in that decision-making process.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I was just trying it out. But when I was reading through your book, I had a really strong sense of thinking about sort of our evolutionary roots. And it was probably about 10 years ago, I started reading a lot about sort of our evolutionary psychology and how we are products of mixed motivations. And sport is characteristic of that. And I think it was Franz De Waal and Richard Wrangham, evolutionary biologists. Now they, I can't which way around they were now, that researching our nearest cousins, the bonobo ape and the chimpanzee. The bonobo ape being make love, not war, all very peaceful, community, et cetera, famous for all sorts of tribal activities, and a chimpanzee, which is hierarchical, power-oriented, competitive and aggressive. And Steve and Pink are talking about we're sat in the middle. We're sat in the middle wanting both of hierarchy, competition, as well as social connection, community and collaboration. And that's our lot. That's what we've been dealt with and we've got to manage. And when reading through your book, I felt like it was a call to say, it's not either or. So stop. At no point do you say, let's stop being competitive. It's let's do that in a way that adds more value to our experience and journey along the way, so that we can do this as a collective, and there's more joy in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's a great sort of summary of what I'm trying, of my message, if you like. Yeah, you know, I'm not anti-competition per se, but I am anti-competition where it holds us back and restrains us and makes us miserable and, you know, stops us from performing at our best. And yet we seem to create quite a few environments that are like that. And yeah, I again share your enjoyment of looking through writing from anthropologists about you know, some of the myths that we have that our ancestors were all aggressive hunters. You know, there's been some sort of interesting revisionist thinking that actually, you know, even interpreting cave paintings, what we thought were spears are now maybe reeds from the riverbanks. But we assumed they were fighting all the time. But actually, what made us different from the rest of the animal world was our ability to cooperate in huge numbers, to look after each other. We have lots of examples in nature of animals that mutually look after each other. You know, there are sort of oxpecker birds that come and pick the flies off the back of various sort of river-based animals, and yet we just see the kind of the lion eating its prey. We just pick one picture. We are not educating ourselves and learning about the full picture, these two sides, as you say. And I don't know why we miss out that collaboration community piece, because it's such a natural urge within us. And actually, during the pandemic, we saw that coming out really clearly. Incredible initiatives, very much driven by a really clear sense of common purpose and need, that saw local collaboration across local authorities and volunteer groups and business groups, which were previously totally siloed. But suddenly, actually, we've all in this together and we can help each other out. You know, that showed to me the power of community. But a lot of our systems and structures put those things as optional, if you like, rather than starting off with those as the way we're going to approach trying to be successful.
We also saw people grabbing stuff at supermarkets. That competitive element, when perhaps there was a feeling of personal threat that I might not be able to feed my children, etc., that flared up.
Absolutely. And that came from the threat. That came from a narrative of fear. So if we play to that fear, if we go out as athletes and we're there because we're afraid of losing, we are only playing to one small part of our psychology, of our psychological capacity, if you like. So yes, we can do that. And I really dislike the commonality, the frequency with which fear is used in the kind of narratives we see coming from politicians, because it quickly drives us into that very narrow, reactive self-preservation mode. And it doesn't need to be like that. We can motivate ourselves in a different way than fear.
So a segue, I mean, you've got a quite a compelling piece in the book about metrics. And for me, this is an interesting feature of competition, but also what drives potentially the short-term thinking is that I think it was Martin Seligman talking about Homo prospectus. That's what we should be called, because we're always thinking in the future. We're always thinking about tomorrow, next week, but we're not very good at thinking about 5 years, 10 years, and investing in that way so that we're making things better. And I think my experience of a lot of systems that have gone wrong or have drifted, as we said, is that people are working to a metric that is driving and justifying action. Is that something you've equally observed in business, in your diplomacy work?
Yeah, I totally agree. When it's a short-term metric, the narrow metric, that is the one that's dominant, then everything shifts towards that. I mean, this is a massive problem in the business world where there's a rhythm of quarterly reporting, and we see whole sort of, you know, departments set up just to kind of churn out the quarterly statistics that are required. And, you know, there's a real sort of self-perpetuating system there. Now, there is some interesting work going on to try and help businesses develop longer term way of thinking and decision making, so that shareholders buy into longer term strategies. There's a sort of long term stock exchange idea that's being tried out, and of course a lot of the ethical business thinking is around this. You know, we know that purpose driven businesses do better. If you look at organizations that have survived 100 years, whether it's NASA or the Royal Shakespeare Company or Eton College, then, these are driven by not just being bigger, but by being better, by the quality, by the purpose that underlies them. So there is a real need to think about actually what we do in order to perform over the slightly longer term, 5-10 years plus. More companies go bust in the shorter term because they get caught in this sort of short-term survival mode that actually is what kills them, ironically. I love the concept of cathedral thinking that is becoming more sort of talked about, where we have this capacity to build incredible projects, you know, literally those cathedrals that were built over a number of centuries, where there was a vision of what was wanted. It was also something very much rooted in the community and the local area where it was being built. But, you know, it was something that then generation after generation took on and added to in their way. So they all shared a vision, even though the vision sort of became adapted over time as materials changed, as circumstances changed, as the next generation brought new ideas to it. We have a capacity for this. The question is whether we, again, our systems are setting ourselves up for this. The medal winning, short term target driven way of motivating us, it only works in the short term. We have an issue of retention of our top athletes now within the Olympic and Paralympic systems, because we've sort of driven this sense of, you know, pushing people over the short term in a way that they don't feel is sustainable, or the experience isn't one that you want to repeat. So again, we can see there this sense of, you know, just driving for that next medal is stopping us thinking about what's best for an athlete's career. It might be best for them to take a year out. Well, that's going to hit your world rankings next year for sure. But actually, you might get another whole Olympiad out of that athlete, or even two, three more, you know, particularly in sports like rowing. And that's the sort of thinking that we need to bring in. We can bring meaningful metrics. That's the sort of phrase that, again, I see used more. We just need to be really cautious. Whenever you have a metric, you need to think about what isn't being measured, what's left out, because that's what now is going to get neglected, underinvested in, forgotten about. And that could be a crucial aspect to performance. Maybe it won't hurt you in the short term, but it might hurt you in the longer term. So with every metric, there's a need to sort of think about what's the behaviour this is going to drive and what are we overlooking through this?
And Ken Robinson passing this a few weeks ago, 2008, was it? 2010, his infamous TED Talk.
Yeah.
And such a compelling case, perhaps the most powerful talk I've ever seen, one of the most amusing, about creating the case for creativity in schools and how actually we're creating a system that doesn't help children longer term. It doesn't future proof them. It satisfies a metric, or it perpetuates long-term, people's going into professorships, etc. I'm now thinking, well, back to the coaches I've worked with over time, that the currency that they need, they crave, is some sort of indication that they're on the right track. And they're probably going to get that from most keenly from results. And that craving for results is such a powerful indicator. And I imagine that that's so true for businesses too, in the sense that when you're first starting out, you need stability, you need results, you need conversions, you need people in the pipeline, you need to push hard in that sense. Do you think there's a phase aspect to this where you've got to have wealth to build a cathedral, you've got to have some investment, you've got to have talent at a high level to be ultra patient to grow an athlete? Do you think there's a phase that people need to go through where they get some results, but actually that means that they can take the time to reassess as they go?
I think that logic is applied a lot in sport, in education, in business. But I think once you start down that track, then you say, it's getting results that got us here. We'll carry on even more so, even more so, even more so. So no, I think it's a bravery. And the important thing is that from the outset, you state a wider purpose than results. And that actually helps you in those difficult times when the results aren't perhaps immediately coming, or at some point where you suddenly have a dip, because you realize there's a bigger game at play. There's a bigger impact you're having. You're developing something at a point where you might not get an immediate result, but that development, that investment, you know, whether it's in a business, whether it's in an athlete, is ongoing at that point. And you risk overlooking that if you're purely looking at the results. So I think, no, it's about from the start having that much bigger vision of the impact you want to have beyond the results. Why do you want those results? What's important about getting those results? What change will you make as a result of getting those results? What impact and difference can you achieve in the community by moving the sport on, by showing a different way of reaching potential? I just think if you haven't got those from the start, then it's really hard to add those in later. And that's the challenge for the system at the moment, because it's self-perpetuating. And now we've got to say, do you know what? We need to shift the underpinning philosophy of why we do sport, to understand there's a bigger game here in which we can influence society, develop athletes as citizens, and help them to come out with a great story to tell about sport, but also a great future for them.
It's hard though, isn't it? I mean, I remember actually, I think it's related as a vignette, but when we first set up Supporting Champions and we were approached by a company that have those sort of electrical ab stimulators. So you whack them on your tummy and it twitches away, and then, oh, look, you can have abs like a model. And we were approached by one of them, and they were asking for a scientific ambassador. And I was, not really sure about this. We're a values-based company. We set everything up based on supporting people ethically, progressively, and in a way that creates impact for people. And I said to Rachel, I'm not sure I could do this. This is not us. But she's like, well, what are they paying? And I said, well, it's quite a bit of money. They're talking about six figures. And she's like, well, that could really set us up and kickstart the business. And I said, I can't do it. It's not my values. It's not our ethics. It's not us. And she went, no, you're right. You're right. And I said, oh, well, I'll tell them that I can't make the dates. We're potentially going to do a photo shoot with Cristiano Ronaldo. And she went, well, hang on a minute. You can go do that. I can come along. But it's hard though, isn't it? It's hard for a business. It's hard for a coach to think longer term. What's your advice for us being able to do that? You talked about clarity of what matters, defining that and staying strong and true to that. What else can people do to ensure that they are investing in the longer term?
I mean, I actually think it is quite simple. It is that sense of, what are my values, that actually, no matter, you know, Messi or Ronaldo, you know, no matter what, I'm going to stick to these. I think it's what will save you time and time again with all of those challenges that, you know, you get thrown at you. It's much harder to survive those periods of adversity if you're floating around and you just don't have that anchor of this is what matters. This is why it's important to find a way through this really challenging time. So it's actually, a fairly simple thing, although it's a deep and profound thing, to be clear about what are my absolute non-negotiables about how I turn up each day and how I will make decisions when I'm offered all sorts of opportunities that in the short term seem quite good, but actually long term could end up being totally self-defeating. That conversation you described there in your own head, it's having that deep down, that sense of, do you know what, that's not right. And those are the conversations that athletes, you know, have to have when they're offered all sorts of wonderful pills that might help them. You know, we have to have such a deep rooted sense there of what's right, what the boundaries are, that it makes sense to have that deep rooted sense that applies across all of the things we do, to understand why, to just stop and say, well, hang on, I'm not sure that's the right thing to do. I want to understand why I should do this. I want to, you know, get another view from someone else. I want to have a sense of, before these things become normalized and accepted. And that's the way we have a questioning environment that enables us to keep thriving, keep learning, and seeing that learning as the objective here. That is what's going to drive performance. But let's not lose sight of that engine of learning, questioning, challenging all of the time.
So have you always had this view there? And has it just emerged? Has it just surfaced? Or is this something that you've had a switch in your thinking, that post-Sydney or whatever that period of time was? Have you nurtured it, or have you had a moment of realisation?
It hasn't been a moment of realisation. I've had a long, slow dawning, I think, is how I would put it. I was totally sucked into the, I'll do whatever it takes. You name it, I'll do it. Climb that building, jump here, run in front of a bus, if you like, and see how fast I can run. You know, all of this sort of stuff, I totally bought into that because that was what I saw in the films. That's what sport's about. I was new to sport, so I had to have a bit of a crash course, and everyone kind of was perfectly clear. In a sporting environment, you just have to show how tough you are every day, every second of every day, at every point. You know, I bought into that macho narrative. I didn't find it easy, and I didn't enjoy it. And there were many points at which I kind of just thought, I don't think I'm in the right place here. And that made it hard at many points to keep going, because I just felt, this doesn't feel like these are my values. But I didn't at that point have anyone helping me sort of really stop and question that and understand them. There was no sense of let's have integrity about the way we do this and this. It just wasn't discussed, because we're there, we're being hard, we're being macho. You know, Steve's waiting to get the blood out of our ears to see how much lactic acid we've made. Get on with it. And so it was really, in retrospect, trying to work out all of that stuff that was totally normalised in that environment, that somehow deep down, though, didn't sit quite right. And I could see from talking to other athletes that they were seeing things similarly and had had similar experiences. So for me, it's been that sort of, a long period of retrospective reflection and seeing the same issue then in other worlds, within a business context, now within an education context, with children going into schools that are kind of trying to get results and think that as a parent, that's all you're interested in. It's, again, that different perspective that helped me look back and think, oh, yeah, this is madness, and it isn't helping us. And I don't think it helped me. I think it stopped me being the best athlete I could be on many occasions. And I think it took me longer to get to a point of performing at the best I could be, because I couldn't find that sort of environment and culture within which to know who am I within this sporting world, not just who am I trying to be. I'm trying to be like someone else all the time. That's not me.
I spent a bit of time reading about metonia, which is about that changing one's mindset and purpose. And with that, a switch in potentially your reasoning and your values, which is an interesting concept. It's based on Jungian psychology. It sounds like you've had that moment. There's an interesting aspect to the concept of metonia, which is where you're breaking it down and then you're rebuilding it. And it sounds like you're on that mission and that cause, that you've experienced it, you've understood it, you've made sense of the world, you've recognized it in other fields. And now this long-winded book, which I remember when I reviewed it over Christmas time, it's extensive, formidable piece of work. Going through, and it felt like you were absolutely breaking it down and every single different perspective. And now you're rebuilding this with a purpose to make a meaningful change for society.
Yeah, that's a lovely description. I love that. Absolutely. Yeah, it's ongoing. You know, as a perfectionist or someone who gets into that mindset of striving for the best, you know, it's been terribly hard to finish the book because it's never finished. And I'm constantly finding more examples and more references and more perspectives and more worlds in which we can apply this thinking. But that's okay. It's about provoking the debate, you know, being part of that debate, helping others to join that debate. So it's an ongoing process of rebuilding. And as you describe it, it's very much that's an athlete's journey. That's the sporting journey, isn't it? Is that process of seeking to understand. And each time that then unveils the next level, the next step at which you can go to. So, yeah, that's the journey I'm on. It's very much ongoing.
So the last C that you've put as part of your kind of call to arms, connection. And I'm going to struggle to disagree with you on this one, because I think that previously we've got some evidence that the high performers, they are relatively selfish, they're outcome focused, they're tenacious, they're resilient, industrious, etc. But I think increasingly we're seeing winners who are capable of collaboration and synergies with people, because ultimately, if they can't harness the value of a team behind them, they're going to be isolated pretty quickly. They're not going to benefit from increased performance. Tell us a little bit more about your thoughts on connection and how that can contribute to a purposeful, meaningful version of success.
Yeah, it's the fundamentals of who we are again. I mean, we're back to that sort of world of anthropology and how we operate as humans. You know, that social need, which again we've seen in 2020 for connection with others in order to live a meaningful life. I think the challenges we face these days are so complex that we can't possibly find the answers alone. Actually, that applies in sport, where we're trying to all the time increase performance. We can't do it any obvious ways anymore. So we've got to kind of bring others into our thinking about how might we unlock performance in a different way to go that little bit faster. But I certainly think the other challenges in our life, whether it's equality, whether it's the bigger challenges in society of, improving environmental protection, you know, all of these issues, the governmental issues that we vote on from our politicians around international trade or international security. These are not kind of win or lose games anymore. There are ones where we need to collaborate. We need to collaborate smartly. We need to find new ways to collaborate. So in my mind, it's a muscle that we should be flexing from a very earlier point in our lives. You know, I love the sort of more modern progressive education systems in, the Nordic countries and in the Netherlands as well, where they, you know, the fundamentals of being at school is about collaborating. You are constantly in groups. You are exploring things together. The peer learning piece is really, really strong. There's a brilliant thinker, Alfie Kohn, who I hadn't come across till I was doing research, K-O-H-N, and he's written books about, you know, again, the way to incentivize, learning and the importance of cooperative learning. That is the best way for us all to learn. And it's also the best way for us to set ourselves up for a healthy outlook on life. Terry Orlick's work on psychology, again, emphasizes the importance of cooperative games in early life, not thrashing each other, you know, Monopoly or whatever it might be, but actually making sure these skills are part of how we learn, because that is the most important foundation to, a balanced psychology and a healthy mindset.
So could you imagine a situation where competing sporting nations cooperate in terms of the intellectual property or the methods that they use? I'm magnifying a question that arose to me where ultimately UK system sports, people were effectively competing for portions of a pie. There was only so much money. And so you didn't really have sports cooperating and collaborating very much. I didn't think you did anyway, that you had people genuinely, well, if we do a bit better than somebody else, we're going to get more and we're going to sustain ourselves more, perhaps rather than representing the system. But I was also approached when I was working within the UK system. I can do it now. I'm not in it, but I was approached to work with a competitor athlete. And I thought, you know what, that would be an amazing project because I can see the potential for that person. And to bring that knowledge in, probably I can see that I could improve their performance to a level that could be really inspiring. But it was counter-tribe. It was well, that's not your job. And fair enough, I was paid to do one job and not work with others. But could you ever imagine a situation where sport does that, perhaps before business?
I can, and I'd love to see that. And I think in pockets it's happening. I mean, one really interesting aspect is that in the Olympic Charter, it specifically says that competition is not between nations. It specifically says that is not the purpose of the Olympics. And it's amazing, isn't it? And the IOC does not recognise does not endorse the national medal tables. That is a construct that we have all created and got very excited by and thought, oh, this must be the purpose of it all. But really, sport, there is a history of sport being part of nationalist thinking. But in my mind, sport could be about so much more and should be about so much more. But I think there's a really interesting part about how actually athletes now shifting away from this aggressive mindset of hating the opposition. Now you get athletes who, respect and actually want to chat to the opposition, to share tips, because actually it's about everyone trying to be their best. I think when you watch the best of somebody like Roger Federer, in those fantastic finals at Wimbledon, those five-set finals, the Federer-Nadal finals, they are just both achieving way beyond just winning because they are using each other in order to become better, in order to explore what's possible. That, for me, is what sport should be about. And in fact, there was an interviewer who said to Federer, I can't remember whether it was after Wimbledon, somewhere he'd just lost a five-set match against to Nadal. And the interviewer said, gosh, I bet you wish he wasn't around, don't you? And you would have won more. And he said, I may have won more, but I wouldn't be half the tennis player and the man that I am now. That, for me, puts the right perspective on what sport is about. And you see when those two are going, they are just exploring the boundaries of what is possible. And if we actually don't sort of support each other and talk to each other, then we hold ourselves back. That's not what performance is about.
No. Okay, so give us a headline. Imagine I'm a coach or a business person and I say, look, I've read your book, that's all very well, but look, I know the way I've always done it, where I push people and I'm demanding and actually having some heat under the platform. That's the way I know it works for me, and it gets results, and it sustains my performance. What's your summary campaign? What's your lift pitch to them?
I want them to look at what more could be possible. What they're not, those are great. We all need to be demanding, for sure. We all need to have a sense of impetus about why something matters, but don't stop there. And actually, maybe your results could be even better. Maybe there's opportunity to bring, other athletes into that field who have walked away because they didn't like that approach. Maybe there's an opportunity to be working in partnership with your athlete rather than in a power relationship where you hold all the power and they do what you tell them to do, to explore how you can unlock even more.
Mm. Love it, love it, love it. All right, a couple of last quick questions for me. This one's, I'm being annoying. I'm sorry, I'm being a bit of a bugger here. you can only keep one. Your ergo world indoor champion, world champion in 2003, your Olympic medal or your book?
Yeah, I'll keep the book because I'll keep the thinking that goes behind the book and the thought process and the conversations, that have all gone behind it. You know, I was very privileged to meet Daley Thompson a few occasions, and I love his mentality.
You introduced me to him.
Yes, of course, in Australia.
In the Gold Coast.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, he gave away his medals. He's the biggest, best kind of winner you could have in sport. But it wasn't about medals. For him, it was about performance. He had enormous fun whilst he was competing and training. And he used to say to me, you know, in those years, in, you know, when we're at the Gold Coast, etc., and we were training so unbelievably hard. We were in a competition to see, you know, how hard can you train? And he would just say, God, you guys don't seem to be having that much fun. I thought he was mad. I couldn't understand what he was talking about because nobody was trying to have fun. That's not the point. But he knew it was the point. And I wish I'd sort of stopped and reflected at that point sooner on it. But yeah, it's about the you know, that whole process of exploration of what's possible.
Love that. And that's a real campaign for finding a better way. Final question then, what year are you going to enter politics and sort it out? I asked you this at the conference. Come on, but I think it was, please, can you enter into politics? But I'm going to pin you now to what year you're going to. There you go.
Oh, time is ticking on. What a difficult time. It's not an attractive world to enter, is it? And I like many others, am not attracted by feeling that's a way to actually improve lives. So that's, the system is really broken. And our definition of, you know, just, I'm not about just going into politics to win an election. I'd want to go into politics in order to make a difference. And yet the system is set up to be about pure competition. And so the way it sits at the moment, I couldn't, with my values, operate in that world.
That wasn't an answer, but never mind. Okay, well, I can live in hope. I can live in hope. Kath, I've really appreciated the conversation. The how profound this message is, I don't think it's going to be lost on anybody. Just that the very difference between this pursuit of being the best versus being successful, I think, is at the essence of this, of actually recognizing someone's achievements, whatever the outcome. And so congratulations on the book. And any book that starts with a Bob Dylan quote is going to be quality. So congratulations on it. And I'm sure it's going to be a wild success. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Steve. I've loved chatting. Thank you.
If you'd like to follow Kath on Twitter, you can do so at @thekathbishop. And do check out her book, The Long Win. The links are in the show notes. Don't forget to benefit from the exclusive discount for the handcrafted award-winning Junius juice range using the discount code CHAMPIONS10 to get 10% off your first order. Click on the link in the show notes or visit wearejunius.com/shop to take a look at the full range where you can purchase a box of juices tailored to your health goals. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so at @support_champs and me at @Ingham_Steve. And you can also follow the Supporting Champions pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. If you're looking for some coaching support or some virtual team development to help support you to go to the next level in work, life or sport, then have a look at supportingchampions.co.uk or drop us a note at inquiries@supportingchampions.co.uk and you can sign up for a free consultation to find out which package is right for you.